What I want to discuss, building on what we talked about last week, and I'm going to repeat some of it, is to discuss the subject of kashering for Pesach and also kashering year-round, because the underlying themes are very similar. There are some small minor differences in detail, but once you understand the structure and once you understand the concepts, the application becomes much more logical and much more reasonable. So once you have this understanding, you'll find a lot of things relating to kashrus, when there's a mistake or when there's a problem, how do you fix it, how do you deal with it, eating in somebody's home that you're not sure what the situation is, eating kosher food in a non-kosher restaurant, how does that work, what are the issues. So all these things will become more clear once you understand the underlying issues that we're going to discuss. The first thing, I want to just say something, I repeat this all the time, that my Rebbe Rav Heineman once said, and that is, you should be in the habit of asking shilas. You should be in the habit of asking questions. And you should never feel that you are bothering a rabbi by asking these kinds of questions. Because a rabbi, after all, spends all these years studying this stuff. And he is so thrilled when somebody asks and puts to good use all of the work that he has done. So it really is a very, very good feeling. One of the wonderful things in my previous community that gave me tremendous gratification is that people were very comfortable to ask on all sorts of issues. And it really is a sign of a healthy community. So whether it's me or it's somebody else, but a person should be in the habit of asking questions on a regular basis. And what I want to present will give you a better understanding of what to ask and how to ask and why, when you ask a question, immediately certain questions are asked of you and what those questions are and how to understand. Of course, yeah, go right ahead.
Why is it fair that when you're asking a rabbi a question, you're already kind of committed to do whatever you are being responded to? So that's why some people are afraid to ask a question.
Wow, that's a good question. That is a good question. Well, It is true. When you ask someone a question in Jewish law, you ask someone you consider to be an expert, you are obligated to follow the answer. And what I would say is that means you should be very careful of whom you ask. You should only ask somebody that you have enough trust in their judgment and ability, that even if they give you the answer you don't want to hear, you're still going to be willing to follow it. So you really have to do some work before to figure out to whom you're going to ask those questions. But that is correct. That is correct. Sometimes a person will say to me, they'll say, I'm not asking you this question. But hypothetically, if my friend would have asked this question, well, all right, fine. So. Right. So we can do those things as well. So, last time we saw, let's just review very briefly just a couple of concepts from last time. So last time we talked about that even though the Torah requires separating meat and milk, and the Torah requires kosher species, and the Torah requires all these different laws of kashrus, but what is it that requires two separate sets of dishes? That is the mitzvah in Sefer Bamidbar, the mitzvah that we refer to as ta'am ki'ikr, which I defined as the theory of porosity. All utensils are porous. And what it means is like this, if you take a pot, and you cook milk in the pot. So the pot is porous. The pot has openings. It's not solid. It has very small openings, smaller than the eye can see. And the milk is absorbed into the wall of the utensil. Even if you empty out the pot, and now you wash the pot with soap and water, but those milk particles are still absorbed into the wall of the pot. If you then fill up the pot with water and you heat that water, the milk particles that have been absorbed are emitted, are let go. Because again, the heat opens those pores, so to speak, and the milk comes out. So now you have water that has a mixture of milk in it. And therefore, if you had one pot and one day you cook milchiks, the next day you cook fleishiks, well, what happened is, every time you're cooking with what looks like a clean pot, but in effect, you are mixing milk and meat when the absorbed particles are released and mixed together with what else is in the pot. And that's why you have to have two separate sets of dishes, yes?
What happens eventually if you boil water in a pot, and then you throw the water out, and you wait 24 hours, or, I mean, just hypothetically.
You're going to see that in a few minutes.
Okay.
You're going to see that. You're going to see that in a few minutes. Now, we said last time, the ability for a utensil that has absorbed particles to emit those particles back, to release those particles back, that ability starts out strong and it gets weak. So, we call that no same tam livgam. The ability to release the particles diminishes or weakens over time. You'll see how that becomes relevant later on. In general, the standard that we use is, if you have 24 hours have passed since the time the particles were absorbed, after 24 hours, the ability of the particles to be released is diminished. Less particles can be released. Within 24 hours, lots of particles are released. After 24 hours, the ability to release the particles is diminished. You'll see the application of that in a little while.
Where do you find this conclusion that you're talking about now?
The distinction between before and after 24 hours?
No, the finding that after a certain period of time, there's this variance in the capacity.
We're saying the same thing.
Yeah.
The fact that there's a difference between before 24 hours and after 24 hours.
Okay. Yeah.
That we find in the Talmud, Masechta Chulin. That we find in the Talmud.
Okay.
Now, the purpose of koshering a utensil is to flush out the particles. So if you had a way where you can somehow remove those particles that have been absorbed, then the pot returns to its original para state. It's neutral, it's nothing, there's nothing in it. The whole reason, you know, you have a pot, it's clean. I mean, it's from your cabinet, it's clean. A milk pot, but you can't use it for fleishigs. Why? Because it's not really clean. Absorbed inside are these particles. If you had a way to remove what has been absorbed, it would be like a new pot, and you'd be allowed to use it. That's the goal of kosher. Now, please hear me very carefully. This is extremely important. Koshering relates to, only helps for balua. Balua is the Gemara's term for that which is absorbed. That which is not visible, but is absorbed. Koshering does not work for be'en. Be'en means visible, present. In other words, if you have food particles on the surface of the utensil, koshering will never help. Koshering does not help. You have food particles. It doesn't matter if you waited 24 hours. It doesn't matter if you waited 24 years. As long as there are food particles visible on the surface of the utensil, then it's whatever it is. If it's tray food, the pot's tray. If it's milchik, then the pot is milchik. There's no such thing as food particles that are visible reducing in their ability to emit themselves. They're there. And therefore, koshering only helps for balua, what is absorbed. Koshering never helps for be'en. Let me give you an example. If you have a utensil that has food particles visible, you have to remove those food particles before you kosher. And if you can't remove those food particles, you cannot kosher that item. Let me give you an example. Let's say you have a knife. You can kosher a knife. We'll talk about how in a little while. But let's say the knife is kind of a not such a good knife. It's a little bit inexpensive, and there's a little bit of a space, a gap, between the blade and the handle. It's a little bit of a space. And you can see there's a little bit of food stuck in there over time. There's a little bit of food particles. You cannot kosher that knife. Because koshering only removes what is absorbed and invisible. you have the end, you have actual food particles there. That cannot be kosher like that. I'll give you a suggestion in a little while, but that cannot be kosher. Give me another example. Let's say you have a pot, goes on the oven, and you have, and the pot has handles. And sometimes the handles, let's say they're on an angle, sometimes the food gets trapped around where the handle is joined to the pan. If you can't clean that well enough to remove all those food particles, you cannot kosher the pot. Let's leave that to the side for a second. Let me just make it, I'm just trying to speak very precisely. If you can't remove all that food, you cannot kosher it. Not only that, if you can't tell if you've removed the food, you also cannot kosher it. Let me give you an example. Can I use a demonstration? I'm not going to break anything. Would that be okay? Gershon, could I ask you, behind you, Gershon, there's a little pitcher. You saved me just in time. A fraction of a second. That was all on the table. Okay, this is not a good example. Okay, let me say. Let me give you an example. No, this will be all right. Let's pretend this is a Kiddush cup. Let's pretend this is a Kiddush cup. Okay, so let's just say you use it for year round. You want a kosher for Pesach, or you got it at an antique store. Or it's treif. You want a kosher to use. Okay. So, if you look at this Kiddush cup, if you look underneath, so you'll see, it's a little bit, I can't turn it over to show you, but it's a little bit hollow here, but it's solid. You can't push your finger all the way through because then you'd be where the inside is. So, you can clean the inside and the outside, remove everything that is visible on the surface, and then you can kosher it. That's fine, we'll talk about how to do it in a minute. Let's say, pretend that this is a Kiddush cup that has a stem. And let's pretend that the stem is hollow. Sometimes a silver will have a bottom that hits the ground, but sometimes it's hollow. It's probably cheaper that way, right? So it's hollow. You can't see up in that hole. If you can't see up in that hole, that's the surface. You can't tell that no food is in there. If you can shine a flashlight in, if you can see it, fine. But if you cannot verify that the surface is clean, you cannot kosher. Why not? Because koshering only helps what is absorbed. Koshering does not help what is on the surface. We're going to come back to this with some other examples.
Even if you don't use that inside.
That's correct. When we talk about koshering, we're talking about the inside and the outside. Even though the food goes in the inside, even though the heat's always on the bottom, we look at the entire utensil. And we'll discuss them. I want to define a couple of terms. In English, we use certain words in certain ways. And in English, the words don't have the meaning that they have in the Hebrew. So I'm going to use some terms, and I want to define them myself, but I'm using my definition. Basically, I want to discuss two terms. One is called bishul. Translation of bishul is cooking. But what does that mean, cooking? Cooking is not sufficiently precise. Bishul, and the other is tzli. Now, if you look for translation, sometimes you'll say tzli means roasted, or bishul means cooking. The English words do not convey the meaning that the halakhic terms have. So let me tell you my definition, and not my definition, but the definition for halakhic purposes. Bishul means to cook in the presence of liquid. You cook chicken soup, that's bishul. You cook roast chicken and gravy, that's bishul. Even though you call it roast chicken, but it has liquid added to the dish from the beginning of the cooking to the end of the cooking. That's called in halakhic terminology bishul. Tzli means when you cook something, it's in the presence of heat, without adding liquid. You take a piece of roast and you put it in a pan and you put it in the oven. You don't add any other liquid, you cook it dry. You might smear some oil on it, you might put some spices on it, but you didn't add liquid to the pan. That's called tzli. You could have tzli for I'm not talking about Shabbos right now. You could have tzli for vegetables. I mean, you could cook vegetables without any liquid, right? That would be tzli.
It does.
No added liquid to the pan. If you marinate them and you remove the liquid and you cook them dry, so to speak, that's called tzli. If you add liquid or there is liquid, that's called bishul. Now, you should be able to tell, and we started to discuss this last week, that in order to flush the particles that have been absorbed into the wall of the utensil, well, the first question is, what's the material of the utensil? Some utensils absorb a lot of particles and readily release them. Some utensils maybe do not absorb at all. Some utensils maybe absorb, but they're very hard to release them. So the first question we're going to have to consider is, what material is the utensil that we're discussing before we're able to understand how to kosher? I want to leave that to the side for now. The second question we need to discuss is, how was it used? Because our sages tell us as follows. If a food is cooked with bishul, so let's say chicken soup, make chicken soup, so particles of chicken are absorbed into the walls of the pot. That's how it works. However, if food is cooked with tzli, the utensil absorbs more than through bishul. So if you put a piece of chicken on a pan, roast chicken without adding liquid, the pan will absorb more chicken than if you cook chicken soup in the pot. And the reason is obvious, because when you have the liquid, it diffuses the flavor of the item itself. Now you have this whole mixture. There's water, there are other things in it. So there, I'm not saying what the halach is yet, I'm just differentiating between, we always look at what kind of material was it, what kind of cooking was it? Was it the type of bishul, type of tzli? Are we clear on the definitions of the term so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the other issue, of course, is, was the food in the utensil hot or cold? The main premise of kashrus, the tam ki'ikr, which we saw from the Torah's discussion of it in Sefer Bamidbar, is food is absorbed into the walls of the utensil in the presence of heat. If something is cooked, it gets hot in a utensil, the utensil absorbs. And we understand that scientifically, because heat causes the pores to expand and they can absorb the particles. If it's cold, no exchange takes place. No absorbing takes place. Now, before I go any further, let me just say, when I say it's cold, no absorbing takes place, so there are two exceptions to that. Number one, if you have a liquid that is sitting in a utensil and it stays for 24 hours or longer, that is as if it was cooked in that utensil. Basically, it's the exact premise of a marinade. That's what a marinade is. A liquid, it doesn't, if it's cold, it doesn't absorb right away, but if you leave it long enough, it absorbs. So therefore, when we say if it's cold versus hot, we mean cold, but it's less than 24 hours. If the cold liquid would stay in the utensil for 24 hours or longer, it would be as if it was cooked in that utensil. That's number one. Number two, we are only talking about a liquid that's cold in a utensil that is a mild liquid. If you have a harsh liquid, an acidic liquid, that sharpness of the acid of the liquid is absorbed more readily than something else, which is obvious. If you put vinegar into a cup, so it's a lot harder to get rid of the vinegar smell from a cup than the orange juice smell, orange juice is not a good example, than the Coca-Cola smell from a cup. Because the vinegar is a sharper taste. It's an acidic substance, and therefore the vinegar, if it is a sharp substance, what do I mean by sharp? Acidic. Vinegar, lemon juice, something like that, that is a very strong salt brine, like which is used to cure pickles, for example. That type of a liquid, if it's put into your utensil, it's as if it was cooking in the utensil even less than 24 hours. However, if it is not 24 hours, and it's not a sharp or acidic liquid, then if it touches the utensil, it's held in the utensil, it only is on the surface. One more exception to that, which we said last week, and that is a knife. A knife is different than every other utensil. There's a concept called dukkot de sakina, the heaviness of the pressure of the blade going through food. It's as if, even though if you take a knife, it's cold, and you cut a piece of food, it's cold. So theoretically, there should be no exchange between the utensil and the food, if what I'm saying is correct. Knife is an exception. It's as if it was hot. It's as if it was cooked. We'll see the details of that as we go along. Any questions so far? I know that's a lot of details, but yes.
Is it only a blade knife?
No, any sharp knife. By the way, not only a knife, but even anything else with a blade. For example, a grater. A grater is a utensil that has lots of little blades. Each one of those little pieces does cutting. So a grater has the same halachic status as a knife for purposes of kashrus. Now, there are four methods of kashrus. That's all? Just four? That's all right? And what I'd like to do is, tonight, for the rest of this evening, I would like to describe the four methods of kashering. And then, next week, I would like to start to work on which method, under which circumstance, and the practical halacha, how do you apply this stuff, both for Pesach and for year-round. But for tonight, I want to be able to focus on understanding the hows and the whys of the four methods of kashering. Number one, the first method of kashering is to wash a utensil with soap and cold water to remove the be'en, to remove what is on the surface. So obviously, if you're talking about a utensil that was only used for cold and it was not a liquid that stayed there more than 24 hours, it was not a liquid that was a very sharp liquid. So then, nothing was absorbed. All you have to do is remove what's on the surface. You can remove what's on the surface by scrubbing with soap and water. For example, let's say you have a canister. You buy it new. You use it to store flour. All year round, you use it to store flour. Nothing goes into it except flour. It doesn't go in the dishwasher. It doesn't go in the oven. You use it to store flour. Now you decide you want to use it for Pesach. I know it's flour to use for Pesach. It's very simple. You empty it out. You wash it with soap and water. You can use it for Pesach. That's all. Nothing else is necessary. Why? It only held a dry utensil, a dry ingredient. That means it's only the end, what's on the surface. Nothing is balua. All you have to do is remove it. Now, you got to be careful that it's a utensil where you can make sure that you're cleaning the end. If it's a utensil where let's say there are crevices and you can't get to the crevices, that's not what I'm talking about. And if you can get to the surface and clean it with soap and water, that's all you have to do. Well, if it is detergent, like dishwashing detergent, that is inherently kosher because that's a petroleum product and that does not need to be kosher. All detergent by definition is kosher for Pesach. If it would be like a bath soap, if you would have like a bath soap in your kitchen, that would have to be kosher for Pesach because that could have a non-kosher Pesach ingredient. But if you're talking about Joy and Ivory and I don't know whatever brands they have up here, but those brands, then that does not have to be specifically kosher for Pesach. So that is method number one that works on those items. I'm going to give you more examples. I just want to give you like one or two examples so that you understand the concept. Yes?
Are we talking only glassware?
No, this is any material. For number one, for number one is any material. Why? Because nothing was absorbed. I told you before, what's the difference between the materials? Some absorb more, some absorb less. Here we're not talking about, nothing is absorbed. Right? We're talking about it's only on the surface, nothing is absorbed. So what do I care? It could be plastic, it could be glass, it could be pottery. It doesn't matter. If it was only used for dry, cold, then it's kashered by soap and water on the surface. Yes? But the question is, was there water in it for 24 hours? So let me tell you something. If once in a while you empty out the canister during the year and you put it in the sink and you put soapy water in and you soak it overnight, then you would not be able to kasher that way. I'm talking about specifically where you know there was only a dry ingredient, no liquid for 24 hours, no sharp liquid went into it. Okay? We'll see more examples of that. But that's number one. Any questions about number one? Okay. Number two is libun. Libun, we usually describe that as using a blowtorch. But it's not what people think. And I want to explain this because there's a lot of misconception about this. First of all, I said, you can never kosher for what's on the surface. You have to be able to remove it. Well, one way to remove anything that's on the surface is with a blowtorch. You can blast it to smithereens and it doesn't exist anymore. So, you know, in the case where, in that case of that knife, which had that little gap, if you can blowtorch it and remove whatever's there, fine. Of course, probably you will melt the knife. And certainly, if it's a wooden handle, you'll burn the handle before you do that. So often it's not practical, but a blowtorch can do that. But again, I want to make it clear, we're talking about where the blowtorch is destroying and removing that which is on the surface. Right? Because you can't kosher if anything's on the surface. You have to remove it. If you can remove it, fine. But let me explain how the blowtorch works. Libun means you take an item and you heat it to the temperature that the item turns a glowing red color. What does that mean? If it is a glowing red color, that is a clear indication that whatever has been absorbed into the wall of the utensil is burned, is destroyed. Now, libun works for everything. Because, by definition, it's destroying what's on the surface and it's destroying what's absorbed. But what is very important to keep in mind is libun does not mean taking a blowtorch and going like this with a blowtorch. Libun means to keep a blowtorch on one spot until the metal turns red, and doing that on every spot of the item. Libun is very, very difficult. I almost never do libun. First of all, because it frightens me. And second of all, because it's almost impossible. And a lot of times you'll have somebody coming around, and there are certain groups that are more into blowtorches than others. And they come around, okay, yeah, here's the blowtorch, here, it was this. It's like, like spray painting. That's not what Libun is. Libun is you're turning it a glowing red. It works for everything. Of course, you should be able to realize many things will not be able to stand up to it. You could ruin just about anything. I have ruined things in my day you wouldn't believe. I have ruined industrial strength, heavy metal things. I was once koshering a Hobart. Hobart is the highest quality industrial strength mixer. A mixer, it stands up. It's like as tall as you are. One of these gigantic things, and it was melting. The metal was melting like mercury. It was rolling off. I could not believe. But you have to be careful because you can really. You can hurt somebody, you can hurt yourself, you can ruin something, but libun works.
So libun will work for nothing.
Yeah, but what's the temperature that you need to get libun? So now,
hold on,
I'm coming. So, here's the mistake that some people make. Some people will say, well listen, turn the oven on high, that's libun, that's not libun. When you turn your oven on 500 or 550 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the highest that a residential oven will usually go, the walls of the oven are not turning red. They're not glowing red. Let's go one step further. What happens if you use the self-cleaning cycle of an oven? Self-cleaning cycle of an oven is usually between 700 and 800 degrees Fahrenheit. Nothing is turning red at 700 or 800 degrees Fahrenheit. Turning red is usually around, depending on the material, depending on the circumstances, which are about 1200 to 1500 degrees Fahrenheit. A self-cleaning cycle is not libun, and therefore, whenever libun is required, the blowtorch is, you got to really work at it. It takes hours and hours. And the oven is not going to reach that, even the self-cleaning cycle. So number two is libun, but it is a very, very high standard of what is required.
That's one question.
Sure, first.
In the first meeting of material, I cover that. If that's not the first
meeting, no, I want to leave it. No, I want to. You'll hear. Okay. Libun is, basically speaking, for most of us, libun is not a practical choice of kasher in general. Now, it's a little bit confusing because the name is similar. Number three is called libun kal. You know, like there's, it's like libun light. That's what it is, libun kal, libun light. That's what it is. It's like the mini libun. It's like a little bit like libun. What does libun kal mean? Libun kal is not libun, but it means you raise something to a temperature that it doesn't turn the metal glowing red, but we assume it probably destroys the taste of whatever had been absorbed into the walls of the utensil. Now, what's the standard of the temperature of libun kal? So the standard goes like this. It means if you take a piece of kash, a piece of straw, first you have to find a piece of straw. Something like a piece of straw, maybe a piece of newspaper, for example, it would be similar, but a piece of straw. If the utensil gets so hot that if you touch the straw to the utensil, it'll start to burn. That's called libun kal. Okay, what's libun kal practically speaking? Libun kal is the self-cleaning cycle of the oven. And even according to most poskim, libun kal is turning your own oven on high, 550 degrees. So 550 degrees, of course it doesn't happen all at once, so I tell people for an hour. What does it mean for an hour? It means 55 minutes is not enough. It means you want the utensil to get hot enough that if you take a piece of kash and touch it to it, it would burn. So that's a residential oven on the highest temperature. Let's call it 550 Fahrenheit. And certainly, self-cleaning oven. Now, please keep in mind though, libun kal only helps for balua, what is absorbed. Libun kal does not help for be'en. And this is very important. I said it before, but here's where, because if you use the blowtorch, it doesn't matter. You're going to just wipe out everything, you know, it doesn't matter. You're wiping out what's on the surface. But here, you have to make this distinction. Because in order to use the process called libun kal, excuse me, you have to remove what's on the surface. And if you did not remove what's on the surface, or if you cannot remove what's on the surface, you cannot kosher by means of libun kal. Right. So, for example, I don't want to use this as an example yet, but assuming you're going to use libun kal to kosher your oven, and that's taking it, skipping over two steps, but assuming you're going to do that, what would be necessary is to go through the self-cleaning cycle once, wipe it out, because if there's any dirt, it'll turn to ash. So wipe it out. You have to remove the be'en and go through the self-cleaning cycle again. That's what will be necessary to kosher your oven using libun kal. But I didn't get up to it.
Okay.
Okay. Everyone clear on the first three?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Those are easy. The fourth is the most interesting, because you're going to have to really think for this one. The fourth is the one that is most closely associated with kashering. It's called hagala. Hagala means purging, to kasher in boiling water. First, just to describe the process, and then to talk about how it works. The process is like this. You take a utensil, let's say it's treif, or let's say it touched milk and meat, the spoon in the fleshy pot, or let's say it's year-round and you want a kasher to use for Pesach. It's the same halach. So you take the utensil, the first thing you have to do is you have to wash it with soap and water, because you have to remove whatever's on the surface. I mean, if it's new and you see there's nothing on it, you don't have to wash it, but you have to remove whatever's there, because hagala does not help for the en, only the balua. So you have to remove what's on the surface, that's number one. Then you take the utensil and you immerse it into boiling water. Water that is a rolling boil. That means lots of big bubbles are coming up. You have to leave it there I tell people 15 seconds. Could it be 14 seconds, 16 and a half seconds, but about 15 seconds. I'll describe why in a moment. You take it out, you rinse it off, and it's kosher. That's the process of Haggadah. Now let's talk about how it works.
Does it matter if it's
hot weather? No, no, it doesn't. And you'll see why in a moment. There's a concept in Halakha, based on many places, several places in the Torah, and the Gemara discusses it. There's a concept called bitul. Bitul means nullification. And the concept goes like this. Let's use the example of meat and milk. It's a little bit different for non-kosher species to kosher, and for chametz to Pesach, but the concept is similar. Let's take meat and milk. You have a pot of chicken soup. If you have a pot of chicken soup cooking, you're not allowed to add any dairy ingredients. That's a violation of meat and milk. Chicken is only rabbinically considered meat, but let's just call it meat for our purpose. Okay? You're not allowed to add any dairy product to it. Even the smallest minute amount, you're not allowed to add a dairy product. That's prohibited. What happens if something fell in by accident? What happens if a minute drop of milk fell in by accident into the meat pot, the chicken soup? So the halacha is as follows. Our sages tell us that what is prohibited is not the mixture of meat and milk per se, but the mixture of the taste of meat and milk. And if the amount that was added by accident does not contribute any taste to the finished product, then it's permissible. Of course, you're not allowed to do it. A person that does it on purpose, we give you a penalty and we say the whole thing's straight, you have to throw it away. But if it happened by accident and it's not discernible in the finished product, then it's permissible. By the way, let me just say, this is the reason that it is not possible to rely on kosher labels for allergy purposes. Because the standard for kashrus is not the same standard for allergies. Those people who... there are a lot of people that rely on kashrus. Let's say it says taruf. And they rely on that for someone who has a very serious milk allergy. Don't do that. Because that's not the standard that the halacha uses. It could have a minute particle of a dairy product that is enough to give a person an allergic reaction, but it is not enough to make the product non-kosher. And I know that there are people, I've had discussions with people that have, non-Jews, that have relied on kosher symbols for allergy purposes, and they've been hurt very much. And you have to explain to them. You have to know what that, you can't use it for what it's not meant to be for. Right. But that's the reason.
If a product bears a kosher pyrus label, and assuming...
Okay, so they shouldn't have done it. Right. I'm assuming they made a mistake.
Okay.
I'm assuming they made a mistake. If they didn't make a mistake, it's wrong of them. We should investigate. We should punish them. But there's a difference between a policy...
The point I'm trying to make is that a hashgacha that you would rely on would not allow minute quantities of
correct.
Of the dairy products on purpose to
correct.
Put into
that's
something
correct.
Still attribute a
that's
hard
correct.
Label to it.
That's correct. That is correct. That is the policy, and that would be my standard. However, it is possible that there would be ambient particles, that is particles in the air, that could cause a reaction but would not raise a kashrus issue. Okay. So how much is it? Well, our sages said, you know, everybody has different levels of taste. There are different people that can discern. Some people, do not have a refined sense of taste. You could have half meat and half milk. They wouldn't know it. And other people, you know, like gourmets and people, they're professional coffee sippers, and they can tell, you know, which mountaintop on which afternoon it was growing, and all these things. So the Gemara discusses that it requires the precision of a professional, a taster. And the Gemara makes the following statement. The Gemara says, in general, the standard is a volume of less than 1 to 60. Less than 1 to 60. If the drop of milk that fell in was in volume less than 1/60th of the remaining amount of chicken soup, the whole thing is kosher. You're not allowed to do it on purpose, but if it fell in by accident, it's permissible. The whole thing is kosher. Of course, that only applies to something like milk that doesn't have a particularly strong taste? What if the offensive ingredient was something like
cheddar cheese?
Well, I want to use a different example. Vanillin. Vanillin is artificial vanilla extract, which has a very strong taste. You know, on a whole recipe, you add only a quarter of a teaspoon. Even a much smaller amount can be discernible in the finished product. So then the 1 to 60 doesn't apply. 1 to 60 is something that is a normal product. If it's somehow stronger or more potent or more concentrated, that's going to be a different issue. But that's the concept, 1 to 60. Now, so I told you that the example I gave you is you have a pot of chicken soup and a drop of milk falls in. So the chicken soup is there right now. So you're mixing meat and milk. If it's more than 1 to 60, it's treif. Less than 1 to 60, it's kosher. What happens if you have a pot of chicken soup and you empty it and you wash the pot? So now it's clean. And now you add water. You're boiling water. And into this boiling water, the water is tarab, right? It's just water by itself. And into the boiling water by accident falls a drop of milk. Is the water kosher? Treif? What happens?
Yeah.
Hold on. Not so fast. So we say like this. The first question we ask is, how long ago did you cook the chicken soup in the pot? If you cook the chicken soup in the pot within 24 hours of when you boil the water, that means the ability of the pot to release the chicken soup particles is still strong within 24 hours. Then we say the standard is the same as if it's the chicken soup itself, 1 to 60. If it was a drop less than 160, it's kosher. If it was more than 1 to 60, it's treif. However, let's say the pot was used for chicken soup and then it was clean, and 2 days go by and now you cook the water and now a drop of milk falls in. So now the ability of this pot to release the particles is not as strong as it was before. It's weakened. It's no sin tam levgam. Its ability to emit particles is reduced. Now we say you don't require 1 to 60, it only requires 1 to 2, less than a majority, less than half. That's a very, very different standard. So you see, sometimes something is nullified in 1 to 60, sometimes it's nullified 1 to 2, that is a simple majority, and sometimes it's never nullified. For example, there's halacha as follows. I just said to you, concerning the prohibition of meat and milk, it's only when you can discern the taste. There's a special halacha of Pesach.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Sure.
You're saying nullified. What do you mean nullified?
What I mean is, it's as if the offensive ingredient is insignificant, and therefore it's as if it does not exist.
For the purposes of what?
Being able to use the finished product. You have a thing of chicken soup, but one drop falls in, it's less than 1 to 60, you can eat the whole pot of chicken soup.
Okay?
It doesn't, there's no remnant of it. You can't see it, you can't taste it, you can't feel it. It's as if it doesn't exist.
Is it the same question, though, of whether the pot itself has also become treif?
No, let's leave that to the side. It doesn't concern us right now. Let's just talk about the food.
Okay.
Sometimes never. Let's talk about Pesach. There's a halacha on Pesach that the prohibition of chametz on Pesach is afilu b'mashu, even the smallest, most minute amount. If you have on Pesach a pot of chicken soup and one drop of flour, of chametz flour, falls into the most gigantic vat of whatever it is, thousands and thousands of times, the whole thing is prohibited. Afilu b'mashu, it is a special stringency of chametz on Pesach that is beyond any other stringency. And the reason is obvious, because it's just a week. I mean, it's a week, so you can be more careful. The Torah puts a heavier burden on a shorter term requirement. So therefore, there's no such thing as bittul. There's no such thing as nullifying. The chametz is always significant, no matter how small, no matter how undetectable it is, the chametz as always makes the whole mixture prohibited. That special stricture of Pesach only applies to chametz on Pesach. What about before Pesach starts? Let's say a week before Pesach. A week before Pesach, chametz has the same halacha as anything else, 1 to 60. So for example, let's take the example of the chicken soup. You have a big pot of chicken soup. It's in a kosher for Pesach pot. And the tiniest drop of a chametz ingredient falls in, the whole thing is straight. However, if you're organized and you have your Pesach kitchen, and it's now a week before Pesach, and you're cooking in your Pesach kitchen on Pesach utensils with Pesach ingredients, your big pot of chicken soup, and by accident the smallest amount, less than 1 to 60 of a chametz ingredient falls in, it's fine. Kosher, use it even on Pesach. Please remember that distinction. It's going to be very, very important next week. We're going to come back to it. So you see that bitul, the concept of nullification, sometimes it never works, sometimes it works 1 to 60, sometimes it works 1 to 2, the different concepts of bitul. Let's talk about Hagalah. How does Hagalah work? You have a spoon, let's say it became treif. Made a mistake, it became treif. So you want to kasher it. You cleaned off what is on the surface. Excuse me. You cleaned off what's on the surface. Because you can't kasher the end, only the balloon. Now you want to get the particles that are absorbed to be released. But you want to get them to be released and removed. I mean, it doesn't help to be released and then to come right back in. That doesn't help the problem. So here's what you do. You take the spoon and you put it into a pot of boiling water. The boiling water causes the spoon to heat up. It takes about 15 seconds, let's say, for the spoon to become as hot as the water. When the spoon becomes as hot as the water, the spoon expands a little bit. The particles, the pores expand. The particles are released into the water. Now, what happens? The particles are released in the water. The particles are now mixed with all the water. The particles become batel. They become nullified in the water. It's as if the particles are no longer significant. If the particles are no longer significant, it's just water. If it's just water, you have a clean spoon. You take it out. You wash it off just to make sure that whatever is on the surface is removed in cold water. And you now have a new spoon. Hagalah works through the process of bitul. Sure.
The spoon became nullified. Doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter what kind of pot you take. Because when you took the pot, you fill it with water, and you boil it, you're kashering the pot.
Water
has to boil first.
And it doesn't matter what material the pot is.
I didn't say that. Next week we'll talk about which materials work with Hagalah, which materials do not work with Hagalah.
But bitul you were saying was just accidental, and here you're intentionally putting a
I'm so proud of you. Beautiful. That's the question everybody asks about the concept of bitul. I explained that it doesn't work on purpose, only by accident. How can it be you're doing it on purpose? That is a very, very good question. There are a number of very good answers to it. We'll leave it to the side. It doesn't concern us. It's not a practical issue, but it's a wonderful, wonderful question. But it's the kind of question that you know, when you ask that question, it means that you grasp the whole thing. That's a question that demonstrates grasping the whole concept. I'm very pleased that you asked that question. Now,
regarding the Hagalah.
What? I'm sorry?
Regarding the Hagalah.
Yes?
I was told that they're putting it for 3 days.
No such thing. That's something different. You're talking about something else. We'll get to it next week.
Okay.
Now, please hear the following issue clearly, because this is very, very important. It's important practically, but it's even more important in terms of understanding the concept. Theoretically, bishul should only work, Hagalah should only work, if you take a spoon and you put one spoon into a gigantic pot that's as big as 60 spoons, because the nullification only works 1 to 60. So how much particles are absorbed in the spoon? Well, I don't know. How do you measure it? I don't know how much particles. But it can't be more than the mass of the spoon itself. So let's just be strict and let's assume it's the whole spoon. It can't be the whole spoon, but let's just assume it's the whole spoon. So you have to have 60 spoons amount. So that means, okay, a spoon's not so hard. But let's say you want to kosher this thing in boiling water. You need a pot the size of Hampstead. So, and it's hard to be able to find pots that are so big. So we have a principle, and that is as follows. Remember what we said before. If the utensil had been used within 24 hours, let's say for chametz, or let's say for treif, then its ability to emit particles is strong, and in order to nullify it, it requires 1 to 6. However, if it had not been used for 24 hours, then its ability to emit particles is less, and it's nullified 1 to 2. Therefore, we say as follows, as a general rule, anytime you want to kosher with Haggalah, the first step is you have to clean the item, because you still have to remove the be'en, and you have to wait 24 hours. You have to wait 24 hours, and then you kosher by putting in boiling water. What do you achieve by that? By waiting the 24 hours, you make it that the amount that will be emitted, released, is less, and therefore, even if your pot is not 60 times the size of the utensil, it will still work. You want to tell me I'll get a big pot that's 60 times the pot, the size? I will tell you as a practical matter, don't try to measure pots. It's hard to do. Rely on the halacha. That's the suggestion of our sages. We only kasher with Haggalah when it is Eino Ben Yomo, when it has not been used for 24 hours. Keep in mind, the 24 hours only starts when it's clean. Because if you leave it dirty, if there's food on the surface, the 24 hours don't start. So you have to clean it, wait 24 hours, and then kasher. And if you understand why that is, then you understand the whole concept of kasher. Now, you should be able to see Haggalah cannot work on Pesach. If you decided on Pesach, let's say it's during the middle of Chol HaMoed, oh, there's this pot and I want to be able to use it for this recipe and I want to kosher it on Pesach, you cannot kosher it with Haggalah on Pesach. You can kosher it with Libun. If you could take a blowtorch and destroy whatever's there, you could do that on Pesach. That works anytime. You're just destroying. But koshering depends on bitul, nullification. There is no nullification on Pesach. You can do it before Pesach. Before Pesach starts, you can kosher something with Haggalah, and then that'll be fine. But on Pesach itself, Haggalah will not work. Why? Because the standard is different on Pesach, and the whole concept of Haggalah relies on nullification, and nullification does not take place on Pesach.
Are you allowed to take Pesach out during Pesach?
No, we're not allowed to.
Okay. Actually, don't belong to us.
Let's say you want to go. Let's say someone gives you a non-Jewish friend gives you a pot. Some example like that.
Let's say you have two
kitchens. Or excuse me. Or let's just say by accident, chametz fell onto one of your utensils. You want to be able to use it? No. If your only way of kashering is Haggalah, you have to put it away. You can't use it. I'm sorry.
Let's say you have two kitchens, and let's say it's already Pesach is finished, but for some reason there were some utensils left over. Some Pesach that were in the Chametz kitchen. You can clean it after Pesach in the Pesach kitchen.
I'm not understanding the question. Did they become Chametz stick?
It became Chametz stick.
So you'd have to kosher it.
In the Pesach kitchen.
Well, doesn't matter where you kosher it. Does it? You have to kosher it using these principles.
Right. After Pesach would be fine. Because it happens.
Pesach is year-round. I mean, the concept of koshering for Pesach is year-round. It's the same thing as basically speaking, the same thing as kosher to non-kosher, meat to milk. Basically, there are a couple of small differences, but basically it's the same. So yeah, you could kosher it after Pesach and then put it away.
A Kiddush cup, if you want to make Hagalah, are you allowed to put it in any pot?
To put it aside? First of all, you have to make sure that you can clean it, and you have to look at the bottom to make sure you can see the end. That's number one. Number two, the whole concept of koshering, it doesn't matter what pot you kosher in, because you're making it all para. When you kosher something, you're making it para. So it doesn't matter.
But so does the pot have to be clean? And then
so the principle that we have, I'm going to get to this next week, but the principle that we have is what we say as a suggestion is, if you're going to kosher stuff, let's say for Pesach, so the first thing you should do is kosher the pot first. We'll talk about how to do that next week. Okay. Kosher the pot first, then kosher the stuff. Then, just to be sure, kosher the pot one more time when you finish. We're worried maybe you put it in and the water wasn't boiling. We're worried maybe you put too many things in at once and it wasn't nullified at a certain moment. So as a stringency, we say, practically speaking, if you're going to kosher stuff at Pesach, kosher the pot first, kosher the utensils, and then kosher the pot again. That's the routine suggestion that we make. But now I'm just trying to explain the concepts of how it works.
But don't you have to pick rocks from the
water? No. 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 Rocks...
That's how we grew up. Because we didn't have my
okay, let me explain.
We didn't have the dishes for dishes like it's everything was
struck. Okay, I'm going to get into the more of the details next week. Let me just answer this question because everyone asked this question about the rocks. So let me just explain.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the story. If you want to kosher a spoon with Haggalah, you take a pot, you boil the water, and you put the spoon in. It's easy. What happens if you want to kosher the pot? Well, you put it into a bigger pot. How do you kosher your biggest pot? You can't put it into anything else. Well, the way you do it is false. You wash the utensil inside and out, remove all the ba'en. You leave it for 24 hours without using it. You fill it with water, and you bring the water to a boil. So since the boiling water touches all of the inside surfaces of the pot, it koshers the pot. And then you would just empty the pot, rinse it in cold water, and it's kosher. It's parv. It's new. The problem is you can't get the water all the way up to the top because it starts to spill. Usually you can only get it up to, let's say, within, I don't know, half an inch. But the last half inch, how do you kosher the last half inch? What you need is you need for the boiling water to reach the absolute top, including the lip around the top. How do you do that? If you take a ladle and you dip it in and you pour it, it's going to cool off. The water will not be boiling. So what you do is, you want to cause the water to overflow the rim of the pot. Please be careful, it causes a mess. Inevitably, it causes a mess. So I'm not suggesting that you do this. If you do it, go outside or go somewhere else. But when you cause the water to overflow, you have to do it in a way that does not lower the temperature of the water. So the suggestion is like this. You take a rock. You heat up the rock in the oven so that it's very hot. You take tongs and you dunk the rock into the pot. The water overflows. Because the rock is hot, the water does not decrease in temperature. You've koshered your pot. Let me make a suggestion. You don't want to use a rock. Take the bottom of a plastic container. It does the same thing. You just push down a plastic container. Just an empty, like a storage container. You're just displacing water. It doesn't matter what you use. Just push something down so that it overflows. You don't have to use rocks. But that's the concept of rocks. The rock is only to help kosher the largest pot itself. It's got to be koshered in, but you have to put it into something else. I'm going to get to the practical stuff next week. No. Yes, sir. If you, the thing that we would worry about is that you would use it wash it in the sink, other utensils would touch it, you would have soapy water in it overnight sitting, those kind of things. If you knew that you never did anything but put the water in and you did not wash in the sink, you did not wash in the dishwasher, if you knew that, then you would only have to remove the end. You'd have to clean the outside very well. You'd have to wash the inside very well. I would flush it through with some kind of soapy water to make sure that through the mechanism of the spout there was nothing there, and it will be kosher. Yes?
I have a pot of water that
you got
to shove it, and for some reason it went very well and it wasn't coming out with the spout, and if I'm a I put that later, it might have been a different maybe.
Yes. But we'll talk about what to do about it next week. We'll talk about how to fix it. You know, one of the great things about kashrus is it teaches you a lesson. You can fix almost anything. It's a very important lesson. But what the lesson means is Hashem does not expect us to be perfect. Hashem does not expect us to be angels. Hashem does not expect us never to make a mistake. Halacha, the Torah, accepts the fact that we make mistakes. And I'll tell you something. You make mistakes in your kitchen. I make mistakes in my kitchen. Everyone makes mistakes. If you have a person that's never made a mistake, it means they're not being careful enough to catch their mistakes. And the halacha deals with it. One thing I say to people is don't throw anything away before you call me. It's rare to have to actually throw something away. Yes, you can wash it with soap and water and use it. Yes. Yes.
One very silly question.
No silly questions. There are only silly answers. No silly questions.
Is it known? That if a knife, you put it into a...
No, it's not true. Not true. We'll talk about that next week. It's not true. It's not true. It's not true.